All right. So now that you're all experts in how you do due diligence, I wanted to pull it all together for you and look at it from the standpoint of the financial model. And I'm only going to touch on four things here. I'm going to talk about geopolitical risk, capital cost, operating cost, and then the various financial metrics we use. So geopolitical risk. Here's my take on this. As Nick has presumably shown you by now, these projects have a lot of risk, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unknowns. So why do you want to add on an additional risk of geopolitical? I mean, isn't the project's technical risk enough for you? In my world, and I'm very biased because I've been at this business for many decades, I avoid third world countries, dictatorships, centrally planned economies. My cardinal rule is I won't go to a country for work that I wouldn't go to on vacation. But we do see a lot of projects being built in these kind of governments because it's easier. It's easier to get your permits. It's easier to build your mine right away. You don't have the anti-mining forces and the regulatory oversight like we do in North America. So if you're looking at this, which countries have the largest anti-mining groups? I mean, the U.S. has more NGOs than anywhere else in the world, but the U.K. seems to spawn a lot of anti-mining groups who typically work in Africa and areas like that. Are there endangered and threatened species nearby? There's a thing called a Red Book. You can look it up online, and it tracks all animals as to whether they're endangered, threatened, or on the verge of extinction. If you decide to build a mine in an area that has multiple endangered and threatened species, you're going to be delayed forever. Indigenous groups nearby. And indigenous groups, you know, they've become a very large issue, particularly in Canada. But understand the indigenous groups, each one is different, which ones are cooperative, which ones are anti-mining. You need to know all this before you build a model. And along the same lines, how close is the mine to a local community? It doesn't have to be an indigenous community, it could be any community. But if there's an established town and you decide you want to put an open pit in the middle of it, you're probably going to get a tad pushback. And then the other one is, what's the relationship between the mine and water supplies? And Nick did a great job in touching on this, but mines consume a lot of water. What's lost on most people is that most of the water mine uses is recycled, especially the processing plant. They switched that over years ago. But if your mine is going to be built in an agricultural area, you're going to have agricultural people thinking you're going to drop the water aquifer too fast and all that. So you need to know it. And underwater supplies, I'll also include lakes, rivers, and streams where people either hunt or fish. You need to know all this because the technical report you got is not going to harp on this stuff. It's going to work technically on the, you know, all the capital costs and operating costs. Now, my next sentence is the most important one. Each one of us has a different risk appetite. And what you need to do is to go in there and make your own assessment of these risks, whether you view them as nothing, something that can be handled with money, mild or extreme. And I can tell you that in the mining industry, if you put three mining guys together, you'll have four opinions. And I'm sure the investment community probably follows that track as well. But over half the projects that we're looking at in this talk are in the U.S. and Canada. The U.S. is the weaker of the two when it comes to following our own laws and preventing opposition. So I went through the database of all the developer projects, and I want to just show you some stats here. First of all, you notice that most of them, their capital costs are measured in hundreds of millions. There's a couple over a billion, but most of them are hundreds of millions. This is good because these can get financed. Obviously, the lower the dollar value needed, the easier it is to finance. But a couple $100 million is still very doable in today's market, despite all the changes and where the money's coming from. Everybody's having an impossible time building mines whose CapEx is in excess of a billion. And that goes for the world's largest mining companies as well as anybody small. The reason is it just drains the pool of money so greatly that a lot of investors don't want to see their pool of investors overstretched in one project, you know, basic portfolio management. Okay, so here's a metric that we use in our work. It's called capital intensity. And capital intensity basically takes the capital cost and divides it by the daily throughput rate. Now, what you want is you would prefer a low capital intensity because it means you're getting your tons per day through at a lower capital cost than high. But if you have a really low capital intensity, you need to understand why it's so low. And it could either be, you know, a capital underestimation, or it could be they're expanding existing infrastructure, whether it's an old mill or extending an existing mine. So if they have a low one, you need to ask those questions. If they have a high one, you should also ask the questions. But if you want to put this in the sense of financing, anybody who has a really high capital intensity number is going to have a very difficult time getting financing. The 50% mark, which is the red line here, is about $28,000 a ton. And as Nick pointed out to me the other day, we were putting this together, you know, a lot of mines have a fundamental fixed cost, and then the unique nature of the mine is where the additional capital comes from. When I see really low capital intensity here, I'm assuming it's a restart of an existing operation.
And that's per ton per day.
Yeah, per ton per day. So, you know, the 50 percentile is 28,000. Use that as a first pass. Somebody comes in at 50,000, yeah, you probably should keep looking. All-in sustaining cost. Now, this has been a pet peeve of the mining industry for a long time, which is, what are you reporting to investors? And for those of you who've been investing for a long time, in the old days, they would only give you the cash operating cost, which are basically the operating cost at the mine. And why did they only report that one? Because it's always the lowest number, and therefore it makes the mine look more profitable. But in fact, you know, you're going to pay royalties. In many cases, you'll pay royalties and production taxes. When you add that onto cash operating costs, you get total cash cost. And then there's a bunch more things because, okay, that might be the total cash cost at the mine. But what about all the other activities that are peripheral and necessary for the mine, like corporate overhead, reclamation, exploration costs, sustaining capital expenditures? So when you add those on to the total cash cost, you get what's known as all-in sustaining cost, or AISC. AISC doesn't always include all of the reclamation and all of the non-sustaining capex. If you do add those, then it's called an all-in cost. Now, I went through this database to look at everything, and about 20% of the companies don't report an AISC, and very, very few report an all-in cost, maybe 2 or 3 out of 100, you know. So you need to be aware of which definition they're giving you, and if they give you the cash operating cost, ask them how they run their companies without all those other costs. So I'm sure some of you have seen this. Oh, it got cut off in the bottom. I'm sure some of you have seen this. This is put out by the World Gold Council. It's called the cost curve. And basically, you take the cumulative gold production and you plot it against the AISC cost. And from that, you see this S curve. Well, again, you would want to be in the lower end of the S curve. Why? You're probably more profitable. The second is, if metal prices collapse, the high-cost producers are going to shut down before your mine will. So AISC is very important. And this is for the second quarter of 23. And I'm sorry it's truncated, but the 50 percentile was at $1,300 per ounce. So that's saying that 50% of the gold mines in the world are producing gold for more than $1,300 and 50% less. So what I did is I took the developer population that I'm using for this talk, and I looked at their, I built a cost curve for them, and the 50 percentile here is at about $840. Well, it was $1,300 for the operating mines, $850 for here. So does that mean all these mines are better because they're cheaper? No, it just means there's a gap of a couple hundred dollars that will probably be filled by the time they build the mine. And again, you want to focus, not maybe exclusively, but you want to focus on the lower half of the cost curve here. So say mines that are, you know, less than 900 an ounce. Financial model. So Nick and his team have put together this giant report and all these giant cash flow models, or I'm looking at investing in a company and they send me their financial model. What do I do? Well, the first thing I do is I check the math and the methodologies. And I just do this by random. Take one column of 1 year, take a hand calculator, run down, make sure you understand all the numbers. You will find math errors. Not often, but you'll find them. Also, is the financial model pre-tax or post-tax? I'm not really sure why this is an issue, because I've never found a mine yet that's a church. Everybody's going to pay tax. So why do they only do it on a pre-tax basis? Well, first of all, a lot fewer are doing it now than they were 10 years ago. The argument the engineering firms give is, well, that's an accounting function. We're just the technical guys designing the mine. So we don't know anything about tax. To which my response is, why don't you call the CFO up of the operator and ask him what an effective tax rate to use or to provide you with their tax routines? So I have to tell you, when I see a company that only gives me numbers on a pre-tax basis, I tend to walk, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to bulk up their returns, but they're doing it improperly. I then look at all of them, discount rate, NPV, IR. You look at all three of those together to see if they're reasonable. And if they are, well, then keep going. And if they're not, then find out why they're not. A lot of times that requires a call to management and go from there as to whether you're comfortable with it or not. So we've got three examples here. So Nick and I have done so many of these reports over the years that we can actually read the executive summary, which might be 5 or 10 pages out of a 500-page document, and tell you whether this mine's going to work or not. And here's an example. You have a low-grade open-pit gold mine that has a high waste-to-ore ratio. It'll never be a low-cost producer. So if they come in and tell you that they're a low-cost producer, there's something wrong. It's that simple. Another example is a heap leach gold mine. Most heap leach gold mines have recovery rates in the mid-70 range, some of them in the very high 60s, usually 75%, 78. So if somebody gives you a gold mine, a heap leach gold mine that has a 90% recovery, red flag goes up. Now, it doesn't go up to the point that you walk away, but you got to understand why they got 90%. And it may be that they have a gravity circuit on there before where they're pulling out free gold and then they blend it with the heap leach recovery rate. There's a lot of reasons why it could be higher, but on first pass, if it's in the 70 range, I'll keep going. If it's in the 90, it's got a red flag going up. And then the one that we all know about is, if when reading this document, you see the word refractory ore, that automatically means you're going to have a lot of metallurgical complications and the project's going to have a low recovery rate and high operating costs.
High capital costs
and everything else.
Yeah,
refractories are, I mean, when we see that word, we start looking for the exit door.
Yeah, I might add sulfosalts. Salts.
Yeah.
You see that word in there.
Sulfosalts, tetrahedrate. Okay.
Yeah.
So I took our set of projects and I plotted them up by their NPV. And I did this for gold projects because all of them but one were using a 5% discount rate. Now, I could give you a whole lecture on why 5% discount rates make no sense. Nevertheless, it allows us to put their economics all on the same footing. And again, I show you that most of the value is under $400 million. And then as you get out and you go out further, the numbers reduce. So then we look at the IRRs. And this is really interesting because, remember, I'm collecting the IRRs regardless of the level of feasibility. I just took whatever they were reporting, whether it was PEA or feasibility. And you see that the most frequent one is around 30%, followed by 40%, 50%, and then it drops way off. So Nick has done an admirable job in explaining the risks and the cost overruns. If your costs go up, your returns are going to drop, which is why if I see a PEA or a PFS that has an after-tax IRR of less than 30, I'll probably walk from it. So from that list that we started with, I would ignore 16 projects because their IRRs are less than 20%. And I got to tell you, I've seen these press releases where it says XYZ company is happy to report a positive IRR on their so-and-so project, and the IRR will be like 8%. Well, 8% on a PEA means that you're not going to make a penny. You'll be a ward of the bank at the very least, because we know costs are going up, which affects returns. Now, in this database, there was one company called Denarius Metals that reported an IRR of 287%. This also raised a red flag with me. Not bad or good, just something that needs a little bit more work. How could they have an IRR that's so bloody high? Well, the answer is because they have very low capex because they're restarting an old mine. They decided to use a contract miner so they didn't have to put up additional capital for replacement equipment. That's all built into the contract miner's contract. The project has high gold and silver. I mean, 7 grams silver and 106 silver, 107 gram gold and 106 silver is those are great numbers. So those first three reasons could explain why it has a very high IRR. However, they plan to build this mine off of a PEA, which is very dangerous because it means they have very little engineering done. And even worse is the PEA is based 100% on inferred resources, which are the resources that have the least level of confidence. So basically they're saying, well, the inferred resources properly characterize our ore body, and therefore we can build this mine and get this outrageous rate of return. That's when I saw this one. This is the steps that I immediately took to try to understand why it was so high. And bottom line to the investors, you don't need to see IRRs of 287% to be attractive. You know, if these guys had used 50%, I'd still be very, very interested. So it's kind of funny that if your IRR is too high, you don't get more excited. It sends up warnings and red flags.
Yeah.
So I know you're going to ask me this, so I'm getting a jump on you. Given all of this criteria that I use, how do I decide which ones to take a look at? So in this database, again, I used the gold because there was 97 opportunities, far greater commodity representation than any of the others. 55 I removed because they had high AISC costs. And I tend to go to operating costs before capital costs because operating costs are ongoing. Capital can be one time. 25 more were removed because they had a high capital intensity value. And I removed one because it had an incredibly low post-tax IRR, which tells me it'll never get financed. And then I moved 9 because of geopolitical issues. And again, we could have a whole class on geopolitical issues. But these 9 projects were located in countries that are too difficult to work in. There's going to be pushback, or there already is pushback. Many of these 97 gold projects, I was also tracking who was stalling the project, who was, you know, filing lawsuits and all that. So on this basis, only 7 out of the 97 would have made my first pass. And I've given you their names and their status. And notice their AISC costs are all pretty low. Capital intensity is pretty low. And their IRRs are above 30%, which means, you know, when they start doing feasibility and others, they still got a shot at being a 15% project. That's how I would do this on first pass. And then I would dig back in each of these and look at all the various things that Nick brought up.
Right.
You like any of these projects?
Well,
don't answer.
No, I won't.
Okay. So conclusions. Nick and I put together our pet peeves about engineering studies to just show you things that we worry about every day and that we take very seriously when we're doing our due diligence. PEAs are too premature to be shared with the public. The reason I say this is because PEAs are a critical document you use internally for planning purposes. But the minute you share any of your economics, it's deceitful to the lay investor. You know, I've seen these projects, PEAs, where they say, oh, we have an IRR of 35.21%. How can you have something with that precision when your capital cost could be off by 100%? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I don't happen to like PEAs. If you use them, go through them carefully.
Yeah, I would add, Doug, that for a PEA, I think it's almost disingenuous to put any kind of economics on it.
Right, right. They should tell you what they're doing and talk about areas that they're going to do more research on. Right. Like I said, we're not trying to sell downside. We're trying to teach you how to look for red flags.
Exactly. What you're looking for in a PEA, honestly, is the ore body well understood, and do you have a really good resource? I mean, by the time you get a PEA done, you should have a resource that has a good amount of a measured and indicated resource.
Right.
You should have that, and again, a good discussion of the upside potential. That's all you should really bank on, if you will, on a PEA.
Yeah, and there's some PEAs out there like the one I just talked about where they're using 100% inferred resources. So we've already told you that their capital cost could be off by 100%, and now you're using an inferred resource which has the lowest level of confidence, they're just collecting negatives, is what we say. Right. Now, if they use a measured indicated and they tap into, say, 10 or 15% of inferred, that's okay. But to do it entirely on inferred is not advised. As I mentioned before, mines pay taxes. All financial models should be done on a post-tax basis. And there's less. I was pleasantly surprised when I was going through all these projects, how many of them are now reporting both pre-tax and post-tax. So that's an improvement in the industry. And you know, quite frankly, it's an elegant problem. If you're paying taxes, it means you're making money. Internal rates of return, IRR, should be rounded off due to the lack of precision. I've mentioned that about 10 times. 5% discount for gold mines no longer makes sense when borrowing costs are upwards of 12 to 15. I know Rick has got a very strong view that's different from mine, but these gold mines are as risky as any other mines. And I think that the discount rates that are being used are way too low. Why are they using them that low? One, they get away with it. And second, it makes them look more valuable. If they had to use a 12 or 15%, you'd probably see a lot of these projects have a 0% rate of return. I also personally think a section should be added to the engineering study that projects how long it'll take to permit and finance the project, almost like that risk register saying, you know, we think we can get this thing permitted in 10 years. However, if NGOs show up, it'll be another 3 years. I mean, they need to give you a better sense because most people reading these reports think they're breaking ground tomorrow, and they're simply not. Another reason why you need a high IRR is because of the time value of money. We talked before about equivalent basis, especially for polymetallics. Hold them accountable. Nick explained that polymetallics don't produce metal, they produce concentrates. And I've already gone through this argument. But again, there's a lot of very good polymetallic mines to look at for investing purposes. And again, I would look at the dollar per ton NSR basis before I would look at equivalents. A report that does not discuss geometallurgy is a major red flag. Nick gave you a good explanation on that. And a report that doesn't discuss project maturity is also a red flag. They really should, in these reports, or if you're talking to companies that you're thinking investing in, saying how much maturity or definition do you have? Are you at 5%, 50%, 100%? You need to know that because the risk profile changes dramatically. And then our favorite one is that you will read a press release that says, oh, we're going to build this mine for 100 million. Oh, and by the way, that includes 15 million for contingency, with the presumption that they're not going to need to spend that because it's a contingent. It's not true. It's not a slush fund. It will be spent. It's the way these engineering projects are designed. You want to comment on that?
Well, I think you covered it very well.
I covered it. Okay. You. Well, thanks, Nick. All right. So that's it with that. Thank you for listening to us for the last almost 2 hours, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. We just momentarily lost Doug's audio here, so I'm going to have to work with Rick on the Q&A until we get it back. Rick, funny, the lack of precision that they talk about sometimes makes me think it's a job for economists at times, 100% errors. And then the other thing, see if we can just get this back up. Okay, it's not coming back up yet, but your thoughts, initial thoughts on the discussion.
Well, I mean, I think that checklist that they provided is worth well more than the cost of this particular. Are you guys back?
I don't have their audio right now.
Okay. I think what's important for our audience to understand is that in the universe of junior mining companies, or the universe of companies that we're talking about, there are probably 150 that are viable out of 3,000 starts. The idea isn't that you're going to use this level of certainty on every single company. The idea is that you're trying to make bad companies go away, employ the checklists. And I think it's important to note, it's going to be very difficult for our listeners watching this presentation. They're going to say, well, I couldn't possibly ascertain whether or not all the information I presented is right. Your job as an investor is to make sure that the company themselves has conducted this level of due diligence on the project. One of the things that's been very comfortable for me as an investor over time is having been involved with management teams like Robert Friedland's group, like Ross Beatty's group, like the Gignac family, people who have done this for long enough that when I ask them the questions, they have answers. They've considered this themselves. You need to know, most of you who are watching this presentation, that if you have a life, you aren't going to be able to conduct this level of due diligence on 3,000 companies. The idea is to ask high-level questions to make 2,900 of the 3,000 companies go away and then do increasingly complex due diligence on the remnant, on the remainder, on that 100. When I grade at Rule Investment Media, when I grade investor portfolios, what I see is portfolios where an investor who has a life, I mean, he or she has a job, they have some hobbies, they have kids or grandkids, and they have 60 or 70 companies in their portfolio. It's impossible for them to know enough about those 50 or 60 or 70 companies to understand them. So it's very important that you, in using the information presented by Doug and Nick, understand that the idea before you pick winners is to exit losers. It's the most important part of this presentation, I think.
Rick, if I can interrupt, we're going to welcome Louis-Pierre Gignac to the Q&A. Welcome, Louis-Pierre. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Okay, great. Great presentation, guys. We're going to try and get through as many of these questions as we can. Brian says, you scared the heck out of me. And what he's referring to is the first time I heard the presentation, I thought the same thing. This is the boring engineering phase, yet there's so many things that can go wrong, probably in excess of what a retail investor could realistically wrap their head around. I think that these pointers are good in the sense that when you are talking with an executive from the company, you have an idea of what you should be asking and what they should have answers to. But are there resources that you can suggest for retail investors to go to? Because like I said, this is probably beyond the ability of the average person to do by themselves.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Nick and I, we actually read these big fat documents that Louis-Pierre and his family pump out. You don't need to do the level we do. If you go back to the presentation, we've given you things you need to look for. If they are discussed in the document, then they've probably been addressed to a level that you would be comfortable with. You don't need to be an expert on all the nuances on all this. So I would recommend that. Our checklist at the end, I think, is very important. And I'm really glad that Louis-Pierre is up next because his family has an incredible track record in delivering on time, on budget, and knowing how to do this. So you're all really lucky that he's going to follow up and say everything that Nick and I said was true.
Yeah, and I think that's really good. I mean, you provided a really good detail of everything that's involved in a project. And like you guys have been mentioning, for the common investor, it can be maybe a bit overwhelming to start considering all these things. So yeah, that's really part of the universe of investing is weeding out the bad ones and trying to focus on the good ones.
Albert, hopefully we've given you enough red flags and indication of what raises concern with us that if you see this, you go, oh yeah, those guys said about that. I need to either look more detail or that number's so far out of whack, I'm gone.
Might I interject? I think from the point of view of an investor watching this presentation who hasn't run Orion Mine Finance, or for that matter, Sprott, who isn't responsible for allocating capital $500 million or $1 billion at a crack, but rather is trying to manage a $250,000 portfolio for 10 companies in them, with 10 companies in the portfolio. I think the most important part of understanding the company at any stage of development, be they explorer or be they senior producer, is the qualification of the management team, their prior successes, and their successes that are specifically related to the task at hand. Without pandering too much to an exhibitor, the Gignac family has spent a lot of time building open pit gold mines in tropical high rainfall terrain, which is a very, very, very specific skill set. They happen to be involved now in building an open pit gold mine in a fairly remote tropical high rain environment. So when I talk about expertise specific to the task at hand, I'm talking pretty granularly. Doug Silver talked about the fact that this expertise has to be reflected through the senior management team, not merely the CEO. The head of exploration, as an example, should be somebody who is exploring terrains and rock types that are similar to the task at hand. If you see a company that's gone through preliminary economic assessment and is now going to mine building, and you see a CEO change from a geologist to an engineer, that's probably not a bad thing. It's probably a good thing. If you look at the board of directors, what you're looking for is a group of people who can support the management team by asking on your behalf as a shareholder specifically the questions that Doug and Nick proposed. Your best first blush, I think, is the resumes of the management team, the resumes of the director, and whether or not they all have skin in the game, whether or not a substantial part of their compensation, total compensation, comes from the appreciation of the common stock, or rather, if it comes from salary or emolument. I don't know if you gentlemen agree with that. I'm trying to create a short form for people.
Particularly for retail investors where you don't have staffs and you don't have the level of experience we do, that's why the boards are important. You know, it's again, it goes back to the three P's: people, project, and plan. And the people need to understand the project. So they have to have experience in those areas, whether it's processing, mining, or geology. And you are to rely on the boards to make sure that these red flags that we're raising are being addressed. From our perspective, when we see a red flag in a PEA, it naturally raises the question, why isn't the board also concerned about this red flag? They should have equivalent experience. And a lot of time, you just have to read deeper in the document to see why this is a unique situation and it's, in fact, not a red flag or very manageable. Right?
Right. Yeah. And then Doug and LP, I have another partly statement, partly question, but I'd like to direct the discussion in the following fashion. Do you think it's appropriate to burden the AISC number and hence the return on capital employed number with the implied cost of capital? When you see these net present values that don't include 12 to 15% project finance, from my viewpoint, I try to burden them. And by the way, I never try to get it right because I know I won't. I'm trying to get an order of magnitude calculation that gives me, okay, I can take this risk, or no, I don't know enough about this project that I can afford to take the risk. From your viewpoint, is burdening the resultant number with the cost of capital after tax appropriate?
I was just going to say, I think you need to actually look at it before having financing costs built into it, because obviously there's going to be various means of financing projects. So I do think it's important to have the, call it unlevered, analysis done. And when you look at feasibility studies in 43-101, by the rules of these documents, you have to have that unlevered. So without financing costs built into it.
No, but I think Rick makes a good point. And I agree with you, Louis-Pierre, that you definitely want to have them unlevered at the 43-101 level. But because financing costs are getting quite substantial, I mean, BMO came out with a piece last week about watch out for gold streams because of the cost. I don't see that anywhere in the AISC, but Rick, I think it's addressed because when gold prices go up, these gold companies aren't making a greater margin because they're chewing it all up in high finance costs. So the margins, I don't know if you watch it, you'd think that if the price goes up and costs stay the same, your margins increase. They always go in parallel. It doesn't matter what the gold price is, they're always going in parallel. Part of that right now is because of inflation and because of the financing costs are are taking a bit of that margin.
Given that the investment banks probably won't show you that because they can't get a commission, my own belief is that it's important for investors to employ, at least in a very rough sense, that discipline themselves, to attempt to burden the project after they've seen the study with their own estimate of the cost of capital. And I also suggest, Doug, that the point that we made earlier, that a 5% discount rate, pick the commodity, is silly, given the escalation in operating and construction costs that we've seen. Now, as to what's an appropriate discount rate, that's an entirely different question. For whatever reason, I guess having grown up in the oil and gas business and using PV10, PV10 has stuck with me just because it's been a constant in my mind over four decades. Is that the right number? Probably not, but it seems to me better than PV5.
Yeah, but Rick, even with inflationary times and higher cost of capital, if you focus on the lower end of the cost curve,
you're going to lose.
You're going to be better off because everybody's going to have some finance cost in there. You're still going to be on the better half of the side if metal prices should drop, and in theory, your margins should go up if the price goes up.
Absolutely agree with you. Absolutely agree with you, but now you're cannibalizing my presentation, which is a no-no.
Can I add, guys? I'm going to suggest we delay the discounting discussion to July, where Doug will be joining us in person for the Rule Symposium in Boca Raton. Just in case things get heated, it'd be nice to have these guys on stage to settle it. If they can't settle it politically, that's just a quick plug, rulesymposium.com/2024. That's the Rule Symposium in July. Guys, the next question here is from Bill, and he says he's seen developers purchase mothballed mills from other operators. What are the pitfalls in doing this? Anyone want to take a shot?
The pitfalls are how well it sounds really good that you're going to save money, but you may not even save money when you consider the condition of the equipment. Look, the thing to keep in mind is that mill went out of business, or it stopped producing, either because they ran out of ore or they went out of business. In either case, it's a situation where it's coming to the end of its life. And when things come to the end of their life, that's when maintenance is ignored. It's just like when you have an old car, you know, when you're getting close to trading it in, you're not even going to bother changing the oil because what do you care? You know, you're going to just trade it in. So the things to look for are, you know, how well has this equipment been maintained? And then how well has it been maintained during the shutdown period? For example, motors, if you have electric motors, you got to go turn them on and let them run every so often. If you don't, those motors are gone. Maybe you need to replace all the motors.
So, seals.
Yeah, seals, bearings, all those kinds of things. So look, there are examples. There's times where you need to look at buying used equipment. I would recommend that if you're going to do something like that, you would consider like a ball mill or a specific crusher or a specific component that may be in good shape or may be available, where, you know, maybe a ball mill is, you know, got a 36 month lead time or something, and there's one available. You may consider looking at that, but you should always consider when you're doing the math, you should put a big number in there for refurbishing costs. Yeah. And also keep in mind that you know, these things need to be shipped from odd places, and if you get a really good deal at a ball mill, but it's in the middle of nowhere, you know, it's probably going to cost you more to ship it than it will from the factory. So those are kinds of things to keep in mind as well.
And there are engineers who specialize in assessing used equipment.
Yeah. So there should always be an assessment.
You're not going in blind, but you know, you got the demo cost, the transport, the mobilization cost, the refurbishing. It's more expensive than just saying you got a deep discount on a ball mill.
Great, thanks for that. Go ahead, Louis-Pierre.
Just by experience, the Rosebel mine that we built back in the day, we had all used equipment. That was when the gold price was $400 an ounce, and you had to be a little creative to make projects work back then. So we had used mining equipment, used processing equipment, and yeah, obviously you had to change the motors out, but the actual mill shells and the hunk of steel that goes into these parts was all still good. So yeah, there's ways of reusing used equipment, but you do have to be careful. Yeah.
But you had people who are experts in assessing the quality yeah. of the equipment and whether it was maintained and everything.
And it was our equipment from another.
Oh, in that case.
yeah, a little better.
Well, that's right. But you knew what you were getting though, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had trucks that came transferred over to this site with 100,000 hours on it. But, you know, that got us going and, you know, we ended up replacing those. But you have to make the initial CapEx fundable and make projects economic.
It's not impossible. And you need to, you know, you need to look at your specific situations. I was on a project many, many years ago. They built a whole 5,000 ton a day gold heap leach operation in Mexico. They got the whole thing built for $18 million. I mean, all in, $18 million. And believe me, everything was used. and it did get them started. And so, you know, there are, you know, success stories, but the horror stories about used equipment, I think, outweighs the success stories.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time here. That was great information. Nick, I don't know if you realize that you just reduced the market for your used cars by about 1,000 attendees, not changing the oil. We're not buying cars from Nick. We got to go to a break, but I want to sneak in one more question from our good friend Steve Barton. He's talking about the Vail incident. What type of dam was it? And I'll add, what can we learn?
Do you know enough about that?
The Vale tailings collapse.
Vale. Excuse me.
This is Bergadino?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so this was a upstream dam. It was it is a iron ore operation. It was sitting on the side of a hill, and look, I don't know how much I can say about the details of
just
it, but
summarize it.
Just in summary, it was not very well maintained by the company. The company was aware that there was a lot of water in it, and they had also they started looking at it. They saw movement and they started doing analysis to see what was going on. There's something going on that was worrying them, and it just really tragic. If you ever watch that video very closely, there were actually people on the dam when it failed. Doing some test work and doing some examinations. But what it really teaches us is that liquefaction is something that happens instantly. It's not something that happens slowly. And really, that's the real danger in upstream dams. And again, it speaks to the importance of maintaining, looking at it all the time, getting your piezometer testing and looking at all that and making sure that that water is being managed and you're draining it as much as you can.
That's good.
Okay, we got to leave it at that. So it's now time for our first expo hall break. Please be sure to visit the exhibit hall to learn all about our exceptional companies joining us today. If you're just joining us, remember you can view all the presentations in the video archive by visiting ruleclassroom.com 1 week from now. Also, mark your calendars for our next boot camp that'll take place on April 20th. You can get your ticket today and save 25% on admission. You can also help us choose the theme by participating in our poll question, which topic do you want us to cover at the next boot camp? Enjoy the break. We'll see you back here in about 40 minutes.